All right, so today
for
is okay. So today is May 20th, 2015. This is the third interview with Michael Rosen. As with the first interview, this is a phone interview. I'm in Madison, Michael's in Milwaukee, and my name is Troy Reeves. Michael, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Michael Rosen, R-O-S-E-N.
Okay, great. Michael, as you know, this interview will be different than the other two in a sense that we'll be talking about a more recent history topic, and that's the protests of 2011. So my first question is a general question, and I wonder if you could recall what your thoughts or memories or feelings were of the summer of 2010 as we prepared for the election, the gubernatorial election of 2010.
Yeah, well, actually, it's pretty interesting. We had, that is, Local 212, our union, gets to speak at what's called Coordination Day. It's an all-faculty assembly, all-faculty and staff assembly, non-student contact day at the end of August, and the Local 212 president gets to speak, gets 10 minutes, and I was the president then, and I spoke, and what I, one of the things I talked about was the upcoming election, and actually what I said is that if this election's very important, and if Scott Walker wins, hold on to your purse or your wallet, or I might have said it the other way around, I might have said, hold on to your purse or your wallet if Scott Walker wins this election. And we actually made some projections about how much he might cost people based on, you know, just based on some, we put it on the screen in front of the whole school. In retrospect, we underestimated what he would propose with Act 10, but we were very well aware that he had called public employees the new haves, and we discussed that with the whole assembly that day, and so you know, that election loomed very important to us.
Thank you. So what sort of things were you doing through the union to?
Well, we were very active in the election, supporting Tom Barrett. We did frequent letters to our members. We did postcards to our members. We had a lot of members out working for Barrett. We used our newsletters and robocalls. We had I don't remember the exact number of activities, but we probably had 10 to 12 direct points of contact with every member of our union about the danger that Walker posed to technical education and to our union, because we saw the threat that Walker posed as twofold. One, to the college, in terms of cutting funding, and again, we never could have projected the kind of cut, the size of the cut that he actually made, which was 30% of state funding. But we assumed that he would cut the funding, and we also assumed that he would hit people's pocketbooks. We did not assume that he would, or project that he would actually go after people's rights to be represented. But in any case, we fully mobilized people, educating people about the terms of the election, as well as getting them involved in, as I said, going door to door and working phone banks with other union members.
Okay. And by the college, do you mean MATC?
Yeah. MATC.
Which for our purposes here is Milwaukee Area Technical College.
That's right.
Okay.
And the funding for technical colleges in the state as a whole is supposed to be a third public, that is a third state funding, a third property tax, and a third other sources. And that was established in the early 70s when the technical college system, Wisconsin Technical College system, was established, and when Milwaukee Area Technical College was established, covering Ozaukee County, Milwaukee County, and very small pieces of Washington and Waukesha County. By the time Walker was getting elected, or by the time of the 2010 election, state funding had dropped to 10%, had declined to 10%, and property taxes were close to 60% of funding. So the three-legged stool model of funding was really out of whack. And of course, once Walker got elected, he slashed state funding by 30%. The good news, I guess, was that state funding was such a small piece of our funding by then that 30% of such a minimal amount, it wasn't nearly as big a hit as if, say, they had been funding us at 30%. But one of the reasons that there had been property tax concern at technical colleges was because the state, through the 90s and into the first decade of the 21st century, had essentially reneged on its one-third commitment. And as it failed to fund technical colleges, the technical colleges used the property tax, which was capped at 1.5 mil rate, but still, with property values going up, they could make up that money with property taxes. One of the interesting things about that issue is that in 1999-2000, I worked with the president of the college at MATC, Dr. John Burkholz, and we both met with the Milwaukee Journal editorial board, and at that time it was the Milwaukee Journal, and they wrote an editorial urging the state to increase state funding by 4.1%. And Burkholz and I would go to Madison, and we would meet with Republican legislators, including Alberta Darling and John Gard at the time, I think was the assembly leader, and they would basically tell us, well, we don't have any money, but raise property, but you have the property tax, so you could generate money that way. And by the middle part of the first decade of the 21st century, they were the ones screaming about the property tax increases at technical colleges, which is one of the messages that Walker wrote to office in 2010. And of course, what they did is they slashed state funding, and they also capped property tax funding. So anyway, that's the story.
Thank you. So I wonder if you could talk about you talk about having these projections of what was going to happen if Governor Walker was elected. I wonder if you could talk in general about things you were either thinking or doing from Election Day until you heard about the budget repair bill.
Well, I think the most important thing that happened here was that we had been approached. We had a new college president who'd come in earlier. He might have even come in 2009, or else he came in March of 2010. And he had approached us in October to see if we would negotiate our contract early, or because there was a significant budget challenge for us for the following year. This is prior to Walker getting elected. And so we had agreed to do that, and we began negotiating in either November or December, I can't remember now. And we actually settled the contract the day before Walker announced Act 10. So we had begun negotiating. Walker gets elected in November, so we knew that that things were not going to be pretty, either for the college in terms of state funding or for the union, and there were rumors that we were going to lose some rights. So in any case, negotiated a 3-year contract, and as I said, I think we settled that on a Thursday, and he announced Act 10 on a Friday, or else we settled it on a Friday, and he announced Act 10 on a Monday, which was very fortuitous for us, because what it meant was we had a contract in place for 3 years, so we were one of the last unions in the state to be under contract, because if you were under contract when Act 10 was passed, that contract stayed in force. And so negotiating that contract provided the faculty and the staff at MATC with protection for almost 3 years following the passage of Act 10. I think it ran out maybe a year ago in February, not the past February, but a year ago in February, 2013.
Okay.
So that was one of the things that we did in preparation. And the other, you know, and the other was, you know, I did have some conversations with Peter Rickman, who was a leader of the TAA in Madison, talking, and this was actually prior to Walker getting elected, or maybe it was right after the election, talking about how, without knowing what he was going to propose, talking about the fact that if there was going to be resistance to what we assumed were going to be upcoming cuts, that it was going to be very important for students to play a leading role in that resistance, because students historically in Wisconsin have always been a catalyst for action and resistance to regressive political proposals.
Thank you, Michael. So now I wonder if you have memories or thoughts about when you heard about the budget repair bill.
I just remember at first being somewhat shocked at the extent that it went. As I've said at subsequent coordination days here, we knew it would be bad, but no one knew it would be this bad, and so we were shocked by it. On the other hand, we were protected because we had negotiated a contract for 3 years, so you know, we knew that we had that protection. We're glad we did it, and you know, of course, we had no way of predicting that there would be a massive uprising or mass movement response to it.
Do you recall what events or event happened, at least in your mind or your perception of it, that made you realize that what started off as, you know, students taking Valentines to the governor's office would turn into what it turned into?
Well, I don't. I remember I was actually teaching a class called Labor Through Film. It was a night class, Labor History Through Film, and we got a call that the TAA had that we're sitting in and we're holding the building and we should come down to Madison. And when I say we, I mean I was co-teaching the class with another union leader in Milwaukee, and so we did. We you know, when the class ended, we got in our car and drove down to Madison together and walked into the Capitol, and the person was also someone who had I had been a in Madison from 66 to 70, and so had been part of several rallies and marches at the Capitol and around the Capitol, including the welfare mothers when they kind of took over the Capitol in 1968. And as we walked in, I said to the person who I was with, who also had participated in those events, that whoever thought that we'd be doing this again. you know, I kind of make a joke, the difference between then and now was that now we had to remember to take our high blood pressure medicine, which is not something we had to do in the 60s. But in any case, so that's how we heard about it. I forget who called me. I don't know if it was someone from the TAA or someone, you know, another labor leader. I think it was another labor leader from Milwaukee. And so we went down there.
So, Michael, while you were there, did you coordinate or work with the TAA or other sort of UW-Madison folks?
Yeah. I mean, the TAA was kind of the leading force. And then, I mean, I think I came back that night. I can't remember if I came back that night and then went back down, or I don't, that's unclear to me now. But when we were down there, we worked with the TAA and also with Bruce Colburn, who was with SEIU, and Phil Neuenfeld from the AFL-CIO, and a lot of my members were coming down, and some of them were sleeping over, especially some of the younger people. When they didn't have classes, they'd be coming down. It was something that really galvanized the active members of my local. I mean, at one point, when there was a rally, we took two busloads of people down. I don't know if it was a Saturday rally or what day it was, but I mean, people were really motivated by this. I mean, they knew that what was taking place here was a very significant attack on their rights.
Michael, you mentioned somewhat jokingly that there was a difference in, you know, you had to take blood pressure medication in 2010 and not in 1966 through 70. But I wonder, you know, now upon reflection, if you've thought about or compared, you know, what you and others were trying to do during the Vietnam era to what was trying to be done and is trying to be done.
And I think the breadth and depth of the 2010 protests, it was much broader. That is, if you think about the things in the 60s, it was mainly students or welfare, you know, the one event I mentioned were welfare mothers, or, you know, on campus there had been a black student strike, or TAs, but it was all young people, you know, fighting for various legitimate causes, but it didn't, those protests didn't galvanize into action, you know, the working class, generally working class people, whereas in Madison, despite what the Walker Grossman crowd tried to claim were outside agitators, the thing about 2010 is that while it was sparked by the TAA, it was working people. I mean, my members were people, they weren't young, you know, they weren't 20-somethings. These were people who are married, who have children, who are professional educators. There were steel workers, there were auto workers, there were skilled trades people. You know, it was the unionized middle class, in its broadest sense, was mobilized in 2010. And that is what firefighters, police officers, and that wasn't true in the 1960s.
Thank you. Michael, I wonder, before I move on to the recalls, if there are events or anecdotes from your time in the Capitol that you would, you know, during those, whenever you came down for those few weeks, that stand out in your mind?
Well, I guess one of them was that we have an animation instructor, Tim Decker, who had done some posters, which we printed. He worked... Originally, he worked for Disney, and he worked on The Simpsons, and then he came to MATC to run our animation program, and he did some of these great cartoons of Walker as a union buster and several others. And I walked into the Capitol, and there he is holding up one of his big cartoons in the middle of the rotunda, you know, with all these young people, you know, chanting and beating on drums. And there's Tim Tucker right in the middle of it, you know, kind of, you know, just, you know, proudly holding up the poster that he had drawn. He's a guy who's in his mid-40s or late-40s, surrounded by, you know, young UW people mainly, but also others. And that was one thing that will always stand out. Another was another instructor who I hardly knew, I got to know through that, was, you know, he went down and slept in the Capitol because he didn't have classes the next day, and he just wanted to be part of that experience. He's a graphic arts instructor. I also ran into one of our police science instructors who I didn't know at all, who was down there. And he's since gotten pretty active in our union. And the other thing, at one point, they had locked down the Capitol, and we were down there, and we had, at that point, it was a night when some of us had slept at the Best Western, and then they locked down the Capitol, and they wanted us in there, and they weren't going to let us in, and we ended up, one of the state legislators who we knew quite well, we called him on the phone, how are we going to get in? And they just said, walk around, and I'll tell you. And when I tell you, just run to the window. And the three of us, four of us, jumped through the window and got into the building that day. And that was kind of, and that we were able to join the others who needed reinforcements. Those are some of the anecdotes that were, you know, I stand out in my mind. I guess another is that the guy who later became the executive vice president of our local, he kept bringing his children down. He actually made a movie about the strike that is kind of from the point of view of his family going to Madison, and it's quite a moving movie. One of the highlights for his family was when Jesse Jackson was there, his daughter riding on the shoulders of Jesse Jackson. And then I guess one other thing, that during that first week of protests, we were having a convocation day, non-student contact day in February. And, you know, we didn't think, with it, given that we had negotiated a contract and were working with the administration, we didn't think that we should, that it was appropriate or that people would be willing to go strike, which some of the schools, the Madison Public Schools, and I think the Milwaukee Public School teachers had gone out. But at midday of the convocation, instead of going to lunch and then coming back, we simply held a rally outside that was well attended. You know, faculty, as I spoke, I threw away my prepared remarks and just spoke from the heart about what was going on and the history of our local union, which was organized in 1930 and was the first higher ed local in the country to get a contract, and asked people to come outside, and we had a big rally outside, and then we marched to the state office building and had a very strong rally there as well. And that's another strong memory that I have.
Thank you. So I wonder if you could, we could segue a little bit, and you could talk about what happened after, you know, the budget repair bill was passed and after the session ended, and that's the recalls, first the senator and then eventually the senators, and then eventually the recall of the governor.
Yeah. Well, once it passed and once the recall, I mean, once the recall started, I mean, once the recall started, we jumped into it, and particularly because we have lots of members who work in Senator Darling's district, and she was one of the targets. And Sandy Pasch had been a strong supporter of our college, our union. She knew lots of our nursing faculty. And so we jumped very heavily and worked very hard on that election. And we have a lot of members who lived in that district. And, you know, I'd say we probably had 90 people at various different times going door to door in those in that election, working on that recall in the Senate recall, which was unsuccessful. Now, one of the repercussions of all of the stuff was that subsequently, Glenn Grossman made I guess this was in, let's see, it's 2012. Glenn Grossman proposed two changes in state law, both of which passed. The first was that he changed the composition of the MATC board. All tech college boards have 9 members, 2 employer reps, 2 employee reps, 3 at-large. They can be retired employee or employer, a state superintendent, and elected official. Our board was changed to 5 employer reps, no employee reps, only 2 at-large, and 1 elected official and 1 school superintendent. As a result of that, as well as another change, which I'll mention in a minute, African-American representation on the board of MATC, which is a majority-minority college, 35% of our students are African-American. Our African-American representation on the board has plummeted from 4-1. The other change that they made was not only did they change the composition of the board, but they changed the way that the appointment of the board takes place. MATC's district was formed as a district of public school districts, and so each public school's president served on an appointment committee, and so there were like 21 public schools with presidents, elected presidents, who served on an appointment committee. And then MPS had 4 additional votes because of its size. They changed that committee to the county board chair from Ozaukee County, the county board chair from Washington County. And those two counties now have 50% of the appointment power, even though they only represent 5% of our students. And then Milwaukee County board chair and the Milwaukee County exec each had a vote. So there's a 26-person committee got reduced to 4, and 2 of the most Republican, anti-public employee, anti-public education counties in the country were given 50% of the voting power. And that was a direct result, I think, of, you know, all of this activity, certainly of Walker and the Republican sweeping control in 2010. Most recently, they've gotten control of the board in the last board appointment that just took place this April. They've now got a majority of the Arab people appointed to the board, and we're kind of holding our breath and waiting to see exactly what that will mean. But they've made strong statements that they think that we devote too much, that we need to be a practical, efficient training dynamo, and that's in contrast to being a comprehensive community and technical college. And so we're very concerned that the mission and function of this college is going to be changed. And we were the only college that any of these changes took place in.
Okay. Thank you, Michael.
I mean, that may seem a little far afield, but I think it was a direct response to it was also part of this entire package of changes that took place with Act 10, et cetera, and probably had something in large part to do with the amount of how active our local union was in the effort to recall Alberta Darling.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Michael. Could you shift now to talk about the recall of the governor?
Yeah, well, we worked very hard on it. I would say that one of the things that we learned in the recall of the senators was that, you know, the way that labor traditionally does these campaigns is insufficient, that labor density wasn't high enough in Wisconsin, that even if you turned labor out, you couldn't win these elections, that there was such a drop-off among young people and minorities. And so we tried to focus more of our activity in the governor's recall in terms of trying to turn out people from the minority community and younger people. And I think with limited resources, we had some success, but it certainly wasn't enough to win.
Do you recall working with any, any UW-Madison folks?
Mainly during the recall, you know, I had actually talked to people about how important it was to work on the campuses, but during the recall, our members worked mainly in the Central City, trying to get Central City voters out, as well as among our own members, trying to get them to vote.
Okay.
So we didn't work much with Madison or UWM.
Okay. So my final question before I let you have a final thought, if you have them, and that is, as an alumni of UW-Madison, I wonder what your thoughts are about what has happened in regards, to colleges or universities since the 2010 election.
Yeah, well, I think as an alumni and as an academic, I'm very, very concerned about what's happening. The disinvestment by the state and the state, which has led to essentially cutting the salaries and benefits of our flagship research university, which when I went to Madison, it was considered one of the top 10 universities in the country. I mean, it was up there with Harvard and Yale and University of California, University of Michigan. I mean, the three public schools were the University of California, University of Michigan, and University of Wisconsin. And the cuts that have taken place, and essentially the attacks on the university, the political attacks, have both demoralized the faculty and essentially led to a brain drain. I mean, I have one colleague who I know who's retired from UWM. He was the chairman of the economics department there, who told me as he was retiring, if he had known 30 years ago what they were going to do to his salary and that he wouldn't have a raise for 7 years. In fact, his real income would be cut and how he would be demonized in the media. He would never have gone into public education. Into college teaching. I know another younger couple who lived in Milwaukee. He was in the business school, and she was worked at the medical college, and they left and went to the University of Colorado. And those are just examples of what's happening to the university. This is UWM, but the same thing is true at University Wisconsin-Madison. And this constant assault on higher education and the commercialization of the university is undermining not only the university, which was one of the nation's premier universities, but it in the long run, it's going to undermine the state's economy, because the kind of basic research, Blue Star research that's done at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and at UW-Milwaukee is under assault. The kind of research that corporate Wisconsin and the Republican Party want is much more narrow, and is not the kind of research that leads to the kind of breakthroughs, even, you know, that we had at UW-Madison with stem cells, for example. And that's the kind of research that the university was engaged in, but increasingly, both because those researchers are devalued and are going elsewhere, and because they're cutting funding, isn't going to take place. So, and of course, when I went to Madison, I think the other thing that is notable is that Madison, while it wasn't racially very diverse, it was heterogeneous. There were kids from all over the state. Today, Madison is predominantly an upper middle class university. And the biggest decline in enrollment is from students from the bottom third of the income brackets. And that's while that trend didn't start with Walker, it certainly is intensifying. There's generally an anti-intellectual, anti-public university mentality and set of policies that are undermining one of the great state universities in the world, really.
Michael, is there anything else you want to say about this time period before we wrap up?
I don't think so. I think I've probably said enough. it's clear to me that what Governor Walker talks about as big and bold are only big and bold in the most regressive sense, that the entire what he's attempting to do is create a low wage. He's basing his economic development strategy for Wisconsin on what I would call getting poor. There's different ways to compete in a global economy. You can get smart and try to compete based on education and research and skills and high-end products and the service of those products. Or you can get poor, which is you try to drive down wages and benefits, kind of the Walmart model. You deregulate, you minimize environmental and labor protections, and you try to compete. And of course, I don't think that's a strategy that can ever work, because the fact of the matter is that there are people and nations all over the world that are willing to degrade the environment and neglect labor, and where people will work for much less than they will even in a low-wage Wisconsin. Or you can get out, which is, you know, outsourcing all your production, which also is a form of getting poor. Walker clearly has a strategy of getting poor. And so you don't invest in education, whether it's public education or technical colleges or universities. And what you do is you try to compete internationally based on low wages, minimal benefits, low taxes. And it's a losing strategy, but it's one that they're pursuing aggressively. And I think it's unfortunate, because what had made Wisconsin, you know, not just the Wisconsin ideal at the idea of the university, but Wisconsin an attractive place, was its environment, its skilled labor force, its high level of infrastructure, and all of that is now under assault.
Michael, I want to thank you very much for your time. I want to chat with you after I turn off the recording. So let me just say that this ends the oral history with Michael Rosen. Michael, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you.